Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Now, as cultural stereotypes go, the figure of the nun has accumulated more than most. There's the comic version. I'm sure we can think of a few versions.
Yeah, like, I mean, Sister Act. I grew up watching the Sister Act movies.
Sister Act. Do you remember The Flying Nun?
No. The what?
The Flying Nun. You don't remember this? This was perhaps before your time, but it was a television program of my childhood. I remember it reasonably well. Sally Field, who's lovely always, plays the flying nun, and she was kind of the naughty nun, I think, but she also had this power to fly. She had the full
Literally flying. She's not like flying around the country. She's
she'd fly over the houses and can't actually remember why, but she definitely flew.
Well, that may be up one end of the spectrum. Up the other end of the cultural stereotypes of nuns would be the unsmiling, stern teacher who, the terror of children. Not many people are taught by nuns anymore, but there are still, all these stories, all these novels and movies where the nuns are like these grumpy old women.
And presumably there's been some truth to that experience for some people.
Yeah, I mean, it has to come from somewhere, right? But then I feel like there are a lot of writers in particular who seem to have been influenced by being taught by nuns, and in a positive way.
For sure. I remember going to hear George Saunders, who's the famous short story writer, now novelist.
Won the Booker.
Really acclaimed.
Just wrote his book.
And he talked about being taught by nuns in his primary school, and for him it was an incredibly positive experience. They saw something in him early on, and they used to feed him books all the time, say, you've got to read this. He loved the nuns and thought they were really helpful for him.
There you go. And even historically, like, the stereotypes are mixed, I guess. There's the whole kind of, you stash women in convents when they've had an unfortunate love affair they're troublesome or whatever. But actually, the monastic life for women in the medieval period and later was often a place where they could pursue education and have like a huge influence and independence and stuff. Teresa of Avila was a bit of a boss, at all the shy,
historians
type.
Talk about this all the time, that at that time for women this was a path down which you could go where education would be really significant and you could express gifts of leadership and all this sort of thing. It tends to be a bit of a hard sell, though, today.
So have you had many personal interactions with nuns?
Not really. Obviously I've spoken to nuns sometimes, but no, they've remained something of an oddity in my life. Not many experiences at all. How about you?
Well, I'm not sure I've ever talked to a nun until very recently when I met these two Sisters of Life. That is the name of their order. They were out here visiting, doing some events with the University of Notre Dame. So I went over to Notre Dame to meet them and to have a chat. And they were very much not like any of those stereotypes.
Wow, they were young?
They were young. They were also like really, really happy. They were totally lovely, which I suppose you would expect nuns to be, nice people. But obviously it's not a common choice, as you say, these days. And so there were lots of things I wanted to ask them, such as what is a Sister of Life? And also, how does someone make a decision like this?
So I'm Sister Jean Marie.
My name is Sister Mary Grace, and we're both sisters with the community, the Sisters of Life. We have a particular mission to spread the truth that we're committed to, and that is that every single human person is good, is chosen by God, ordained with inherent dignity, and that's a truth that we think is worth proclaiming and standing by. And we also recognize too that in this world that's something that's hard to remember.
A lot of nuns these days dress like anyone else, and they don't necessarily live in a convent, but the Sisters of Life definitely look like nuns. They're not in the black and white habit like in Sister Act. They wear a white tunic with a navy blue scapula, that's kind of the long outer garment over the top, and a white veil with a blue headband, I think. I'm not totally sure I've got these terms right. But basically, they look a lot lighter or more summery almost than what you're picturing.
So we wear what we call a holy habit, and we wear a veil. I guess it's hard to describe it without being able to see it. But when you see us, it's obvious that we don't dress like the rest of the world. And part of this religious habit or holy habit is to be a reminder to the world. It's like a visible witness that heaven is real, that God is real, that there's something worth giving up for. Basically, as religious, as women religious, we are consecrated to Christ. We are set apart for him. And this veil reminds us of weddings, right? So we're basically brides of Christ. You know, we're married to him because ultimately God wants, he desires each of us to be united to him fully in heaven. Or in a sense, the Bible often uses a spousal analogy, like, you know, husband and wife. He wants to marry us.
But sometimes we've been mistaken for many other things. We have a convent in New York City, and one night I think our sisters were walking on the streets back to one of our convents, and a group approached them and said, "Hey, sisters, what's the show on Broadway tonight?" Just have no idea that, you see a lot of things in New York, and we're just part of it.
Yes.
And then, you know, when we were in Sydney too, like a little girl boarded a bus one day when there were a few of us on a bus and said, "Look, Mum, all these women are getting married today." You know,
wow.
So it's a sight unseen. Not many people see it before, and it's not always easy to see or understand why we're wearing it for what purpose. But it's very much shaped like that of a wedding dress. So we have, as Sister said, like a veil. And really, in the essence of it is that we're trying to, as Sister said, be a witness that God is real, that there is a greater being that cares, and actually a greater being that cares a lot, so much that he would love a human person, like the love of a man and a woman on their wedding day, that God's love is actually that personal and powerful.
This came up a lot in our conversation, this Brides of Christ idea, like the TV show. Though, to be honest, I don't remember the TV show Brides of Christ, but people talk about it. I've heard of it.
No, I haven't seen it either. But this idea of the Bride of Christ, I must admit it's a bit of a strange concept to me, but it comes from the Bible, of course, where it's an image of the church or God's people being loved by him in the way a husband loves his wife, a devoted husband. So I'm interested to hear more from the sisters on what the concept means for their lives. Was this something they always wanted to be or to do?
No, not at all. For both of them, actually, this was a very foreign concept growing up. It's been quite a journey. Here's Sister Jean Marie.
I grew up in a Catholic family, and I knew God was real and God loved me and all of that. But I never actually wanted to be a sister, probably because I grew up in Malaysia and we hardly saw any sisters around. And those that we did see were mostly old, and they were dressed as regular people. So there was never any real attraction because I loved having fun, adventures, and all of that kind of things.
This was something both of the sisters talked about, that their impression of women religious, a term for being a nun, was that it would be about giving things up, not having any fun, not having the life they really wanted. That changed in particular when they met some actual sisters.
When I was an adult, actually, I went to a young adult Catholic summer school in New Zealand, and they said there, pray about your vocation. And part of that openness was also because there were many young religious who were wearing a beautiful habit, joyful, which actually opened my heart up to even consider it, because these people were happy. They weren't just grumpy and old and, you know, all of that. Yeah, so I started praying about my vocation, asking the Lord to show me his will. And one very key point that happened actually was after World Youth Day in Sydney, I actually came back to my faith. You know, I just knew that to be truly happy, doing the will of God is what would actually lead to my true happiness. And I went to a confession once with a priest who's actually from Sydney. And after my long, hour-long confession, he asked me, "Do you want to be a saint?" And the first thing I said was, yes, you know, as a reaction, yes, because I didn't want to look bad, right? But the truth was, what was going through my brain was, no, it would be a life of suffering. I'd have to give this up, give that up. No. So now he's talking and I'm distracted with, oh my gosh, I just lied to this priest right after confession. So I said, "Father, stop, stop." The truth is, when I said yes to your question, I was actually thinking, no, I don't really want to be a saint because I'd have to give this up. I have to live a life of suffering, penance, mortification, etc. And then he laughed at me and then he said, "You know what? The truth is, if you try your best to be a saint and to do the will of God, you will be the happiest person in the world. And so I took his advice and I started seeking the will of God in all things, including my vocation, not just assuming it's marriage. And so one thing leads to another, prayed about it, felt the Lord calling me. They led me to the Sisters of Life. And here I am today. And I could not imagine a life any happier than being a religious.
For Sister Mary Grace, too, this was a really unexpected decision.
Well, I sure didn't grow up with nuns either. My only exposure to nuns, I think, was in the movies when they were singing and dancing. And I actually do remember some sisters coming to my school once, but all I remember was that they did not eat chocolate and they didn't go to the beach on the weekend. So again, I was like, it's just, it's never meant to be. It's just not going to work out. I won't be happy. But to be honest, I didn't think people were doing this anymore. And it wasn't until I was going to university, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life, but I knew I wanted to do something great. I remember one afternoon actually driving over to the beach to try and get a night surf after school. And I remember having this moment where I was like, wow, God, I want to do something great with my life. You know, I want to do something meaningful. I don't want to just get by. I don't want to just sit by in an office all day. I don't know. I just desire to do something great. I have no idea what it looks like. I love sport. I loved my faith. I had good family and friends, but I just had no particular direction. So anyway, I went to university. And then again, World Youth Day hit Sydney in 2008, where basically 500,000 Catholics from all over the world descended on the city of Sydney. And so too, it seemed like all of Rome and all the nuns and priests that ever lived and existed. And I remember meeting the sisters for the first time in my life. And I thought, oh my God, they are normal. They are real. They're approachable. There's a joy and a peace about them that I had not seen before. And it was striking and confronting, actually. I was like, wow, what is it about them? They've given up everything I'm looking for. You know, they've given up a career, a family of their own. It didn't make sense to me at first, but I was struck by them. And I was struck by how relatable they were. And I remember one night they were singing to us in an event. And I remember sitting there and I just started crying and crying. And I didn't really know why, and crying and crying. And I remember almost experiencing like I was being filled with love. And experiencing, perhaps for the first time in my life, a personal encounter with God, that these sisters embodied the one that they were married to, Christ, and he was touching me. And I knew in that experience that that was what I was looking for, and I wanted more of it.
This personal experience of God, which is hard to understand, especially if you're someone who doesn't believe in God, and even if you're someone who does, is a key piece of the puzzle here. Both Sister Mary Grace and Sister Jean Marie were very clear that it was looking for happiness and fulfillment that led them down this path. It's not a choice that led them away from those things. For Sister Mary Grace, it took a good few years after that night to arrive at that decision. She went off to university, she got a job that she loved, she was really enjoying life, but she also felt like something was missing.
And again, it was another time when I was driving over Anzac Bridge. I remember, I'll never forget, I was driving home and I thought, I'm 21. I got a job I love. I have the car I want. It was convertible. That helped. Yeah. I was on my way to the beach. I thought, oh my gosh, I am so content with my life, but I'm not satisfied. And I said, God, I'm so grateful for everything in my life, but I'm not content. I want more. I want something more. And then I realized, I thought, I have everything, but I want more. I would change everything in my life if I could have you. And I was like, oh, mouse out. Like, oh my gosh, what is that? And I was taken back to that moment at university where I was like, something happened there where I experienced a love inside of me that I hadn't experienced before, and I wanted more of it, and it hadn't left me 3 or 5 years later. So I began to contact the sisters and try and figure this whole sister thing out. And I was in contact with the sisters for a while. And then I eventually went over to New York. I didn't tell anyone I was going. No, the last thing people thought I was doing visiting New York for a month was to visit a convent. So I thought I was safe and secure. So I went over and I visited the sisters and I really asked God. I was like, what do you want from me? What do you want of my life? Do you want me to become a nun? Is this what your desire is for me? Is this what your will is? Do you want me to be married? I was a little bit confused and I wondered whether I'd ever know. And it wasn't until finally one night when I was sitting in prayer and just asking God, for the first time I was really real with him, and I said, Lord, I was like, God, I want to love you like these sisters love you. I want to serve you like they serve you. I want to belong to you like they belong to you. That's what I want. As crazy and as obscure as that sounds, I want this. And I really felt like he said to me, in a very simple and normal way, like a thought that passing over my head, what if what you want is what I want, and what I want is what you want for your life? And I realized immediately, wow, everything that God desires of your heart and mine, and the deepest desires of my heart, and what God wants for us, are not two separate things that we need to figure out and like force to go together. But God's deepest desires for us and what will make us truly happy are the same. And that he desires us to be fulfilled. He wants us to know his love. He wants us to live freely and fully alive. And when I realized that, immediately the fear left me. And I thought, I have nothing to be afraid of in asking God what he wants for me, because he wants me happy. And I can follow my heart and I can listen to it, because he'll lead me that path. Now, of course, again, I had a lot of difficult decisions to make and tough challenges to face. And one of them being was leaving my country, Sydney, Australia. I mean, you can't get much better than Sydney, Australia. I mean, I went from the beach to the Bronx. That just doesn't happen overnight. I mean, I switched my thongs to black school shoes. These things don't happen lightly. Love intervened in my life, and I came to know God as love and someone who is personal and wants to be involved in my life. And when I knew that, like anyone who falls in love, you're capable of doing things that you never thought you could do before. And that's what led me here.
You're listening to Life and Faith, and we're hearing from Sister Jean Marie and Sister Mary Grace from the Sisters of Life. They've taken very countercultural vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. It's hard to imagine a choice that goes more against the grain of our time.
Yeah, it really is countercultural on every level that you can think of. I mean, it's a huge commitment and sacrifice at a time when we're very into keeping our options open. It's choosing celibacy in an age that's obsessed with sex and romance. And even the way that they live communally, convent life, is very different from how independent and disconnected we often are from each other now. I asked them about this. Sister Jean Marie did point out, first of all, that it is a big decision and they don't exactly rush into it.
We actually start with temporary vows. So there's a period of formation to start with for about 9 months, where we basically go through the transition from being out in the world and having total autonomy on whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do, to the rhythm of religious life, you know, to daily prayer, regular prayer, to living in community with our sisters. And then we have 2 years of formation with our community of novitiate, where we receive the holy habit, we receive a religious name. After 2 years of formation, we then have the opportunity to profess our first vows. And for us, we profess 3 years. Initially, it's a three-year period. And then at the end of 3 years, there's opportunity to, if you're invited, to profess, to renew our vows for another 2 years. So as you can see,
yeah, the trial period.
Probation, that's right, because it is a big decision, as you said, you know, it is for the rest of our life when we profess final vows. So it's a minimum, I guess, approximately 8 years before we would profess final vows. And for us, when we do profess final vows, we actually receive a wedding ring. You know, it's till death do we part. So in that sense, it is very beautiful, because the church knows that it is a big decision and it takes time to really grow and deepen and really discover the Lord's plan in its fullness for us. You know, and no time spent in a convent is ever wasted, because we grow so much. We receive so many graces.
So do people leave?
Yeah, basically from the moment we enter until we profess final vows.
Which is like a wedding day.
Which is like the big, big wedding day, which is about an 8-year period. That whole period is a time of discernment, of seeking deeper. What is the Lord calling me to? Is he calling me to give myself definitively? And this whole 8 years, I guess, is a period of really coming to that certainty that, yes, Jesus is calling me to be perpetually his bride, you know, as a religious sister in this order, or not. Yeah, so people do leave up to that stage.
Yeah, and I think love desires to commit. Love desires to focus on someone ultimately. Love is relational, And I just recently professed what we call first vows, which is probably like the first big commitment with the community, where you, as Sister Jean said, profess vows of poverty, chastity, obedience, which really is poverty, to be poor, to depend on God for everything. It's ways of living like Christ, to be chaste, to love, to let the love of God be our only love, to let Him fulfill all our desires, and obedience, to obey what the Father asks of us, because what the Father intends of us is always good and for us. And you know, when I just last August, I professed my first vows, and you know, that day, so it was like a wedding day for me, it was really an experience of freedom, because it was the first time that I was able to say, Lord, I love you so much that I actually desire to commit myself to you like a bride does on her wedding day to her spouse. I mean, any woman walking down that aisle on her wedding day is not thinking about any other man but that one at the end of the aisle. And I think love ultimately desires to give itself away to the beloved, to the other person that is loved. And it's the same in religious life, is ultimately we're driven by love and our focus is love himself. So that as sisters, to commit is actually an experience of freedom, because that person we're committing to has a face and a name, Jesus Christ. And yes, there are sacrifices, there are offerings. But, you know, it's every day I see in the missions of the mums that live with us that, you know, stay late up at night, getting up for their children that are crying, or that make sacrifices during their day to go to work so to provide for their food for their children at night. Love is demanding and takes sacrifice, but at the same time, it's the most fulfilling thing as well, because it has a focus, it has a person. And as religious, that is God himself.
The wedding language is so interesting here, because, you know, this is another very counter-cultural thing about the choices you've made, is that, like our culture, every rom-com tells you that a romantic relationship and sex are the most fulfilling thing. Like, you won't be fulfilled as a human without those things. How do you respond to that? Mm-hmm. How do you give that up and give up the possibility of that and be cool with that?
I think the most beautiful thing is that I have been amazed by what I have been invited to take on. That is what struck me, that, you know, before I knew religious, to me, religious seemed like the women that said no, that said no pleasure, no fun, it's going to be a tough, hard life, I love God, so I'm going to say no to anything other than anything that has to pertain to God. And it has been the most surprising experience to see that as religious, we take on so much more. Yes, God asks us to set aside perhaps the possibility of having our own family, to take on his family. He asks us not to marry another man on this earth so that we can take on him as our spouse, that he will provide for me, that he will actually satisfy those very deepest desires that I have as a woman to be fulfilled, to be loved, to be treasured, to be chosen, to be noticed. And he fulfills it, you know, and those desires he placed in every human heart, in yours and mine, he desires to fulfill through the beautiful marriages that we've come from, the families that have brought us up. But as religious, God calls us to himself and he satisfies them over and abundantly. And I can only say that by the joy that I've experienced already, that I have lacked nothing and only taken on more than what I even expected to receive in this life.
In terms of giving up, what looks like giving up, I know the world so says, like, how can you give up all the good things that God has given us? But ultimately, what we are called to as human beings is to love God, to love others, and to receive God's love, and to receive the love of others. And we're all called to chastity, to a pure kind of love, to look at others and to desire to love them in the sense of desiring the true good of that person. And the opposite of love is not hate, as we usually think, but is use. I think our culture has so much experienced this confusing love with use and feeling used. And that life of, you know, I guess the pleasures of the world, it never leaves us fulfilled. You know, it leaves us only wanting more or feeling used or feeling cheated when the relationship ends.
So do you only work with women who believe what you believe?
Absolutely not. No, we have a... We have the whole world in our convents. It's yes. Beautiful. Yeah, we have. No, we don't limit those who come into our care, whoever is in need.
And how do you help them? Tell me about your work.
Oh, okay. Well, one of our major missions is what we call the Visitation Mission. And it's based on the mystery of the Visitation in the Bible, where Mary, after she has conceived Christ in her womb, she visits Elizabeth, her cousin, and she basically brings Christ to her cousin, you know. So she brings God to the world, to people. And so in the visitation mission, women who are pregnant are and who are in need and often also vulnerable to abortion actually come to us. And we accompany them, we walk with them, we support them.
Here's what's different about the Sisters of Life as compared with other orders of nuns. The fourth vow they take after the standard poverty, chastity, obedience is to protect and enhance the sacredness of human life. This means lots of different things, but they have a focus that the political term for this is pro-life. That term often carries connotations of something judgmental and restrictive, of wanting to control women. And the sisters want to challenge that equation. Here's Sister Mary Grace.
It's funny, I was just in line for a bathroom recently, which, as you know, us women, we have great conversations in those places. Good things happen. Well, I was in the line for a bathroom and a woman tapped me on the shoulder and she said, "Oh, hi, sister. What kind of sister are you?" And I said, "Oh, I'm a sister of life." And she said, "Oh, I know you." She said, "You're the radical anti-choice nuns." And I was like, wow, okay, not the lightest bathroom conversation, but okay. I said, "Well, actually," I said, "you know, I'd like to think we're more known as the radical pro-woman nuns." And she wasn't quite convinced and a little bit confused at what I had said. And I said, "You know, it's often choice that we see women are deprived of when they find themselves in unexpected pregnancies. A lot of the women will come to us and say, 'I feel like I have no choice.' Or they'll go through with an abortion and say, 'I feel like I had no other choice, that was all I had.'" And we simply stand with solidarity with women that are in difficult situations, that find themselves pregnant or in unideal situations, and we stand with them in their place and say, "Hey, you can do this. There are resources and support for you. There are other options. You have the courage and the freedom to make a choice, and we'll be with you and we'll help you find a pathway through this fear so that you can be courageous and make a decision most suitable for you." And what we have found is that a lot of women don't know that when they turn up to abortion clinic, that they are terrified and scared and often feel like that's their only option. And we just hope that we can stand with them and say that there is actually another choice and it's on offer for you and we love you and we'll be with you in it.
What if they choose the abortion?
And many do. Many of the women that we walk with do. And it's a sorrow and we continue to walk with them. And that is another beautiful ministry that we have, a ministry that we're privileged to walk with women that have suffered the real effects of an abortion. And that's one of our most beautiful missions because we see the power of God's mercy and love that is unconditional, that loves a woman back to life, to be able to find joy and healing and new life where she didn't think it was possible again.
I asked Sister Jean Marie what that work looks like practically.
So it could be materially with diapers, strollers, prams, etc. And often is they are facing enormous pressure, especially in the culture today where everyone is telling them, "Oh, you can't have a baby right now. You haven't finished school." And all these pressures, you know, even from the father of the baby, from their own family to basically end the life of the baby. And we are there to be with them, to love them, to let them know of their own goodness, of their inherent dignity, that they are loved and that they can love. So we really, we support these women, we walk with them, we let them know that there are options, there are choices, there, you know, there's people who want to support them, who want to journey with them. Yeah, and we also have a big network of co-workers of life, and they're basically lay people who live in the world, and they open up their hearts, they open up their resources to support the women that we serve. Yeah, there was once a, we'll call her Monica. She called the Sisters of Life asking about something practical. I think it was about housing or where can I get housing. And the sister's talking to her and she asks her, "Oh, how many children do you have?" She says, "Oh, I have 3 and I'm 8 weeks pregnant, but I'm going to have an abortion tomorrow." And our sister's, you know, a bit shocked. It's like, oh, okay. Wow, you're pregnant with your 4th one. That's beautiful. And, you know, she tries to love her, let her know, "Oh, well, would you like to come in and talk to us? You know, we support women who are pregnant and facing difficult decisions and situations. We'd love to have a, you know, cookies chat, chat with you." So Monica takes down our number and address, and she says, "Okay, I'll come see you in the morning before my abortion. Fine, I'll come talk to you all." right? And now the next morning she calls saying, you know what, I'm just too busy, I'm not going to come. I'll come see you afterwards. And this is, she's going to come see us after her abortion appointment. And so our sisters, we send out faxes between convents to ask for prayer. So here we are sending out faxes. Everyone, please pray. So we're praying. Now, Monica, she leaves with her cousin. I think her cousin picks her up. She grabs her dress on the counter. And as she's driving, she arrives at our convent. She sees a sister walking out of the convent. She's like, oh no, she grabbed the wrong address. She grabbed the address of our convent. And so, by the grace of God, she came in. You know, instead of turning around and finding the proper address, she came into our convent and spoke to us. And what we do as sisters is, you know, people sometimes think we try to convince people or have really good arguments to try to convince them to choose life. But really what we do is love the women. You know, we talk to them. We find out their hopes and dreams. Mm-hmm. We let them open up their hearts, you know, voice their concerns. Mm-hmm. And we're there to support them. We love them. We tell them they're not alone, mm-hmm. that we are here with you. And anyway, by the end of that conversation, Monica chose life. So she decided to keep her baby. And now she knew she had to move out of New York because it's just not a conducive place to raise a family, plus all the pressures and the culture. And so she had family somewhere in Florida, I think. And so we're trying to like help her. So our sister sent out an email to our co-workers. Within 15 minutes, someone emails back offering to purchase the flights through a frequent flyer for her and the family. So now the flights were sorted. And then someone else said, I have a house that's empty in Florida. I can provide it for this for the woman. Great, accommodation sorted. And then now, just before the move, she's prepared to leave all her things behind because, you know, she can't shift everything so far on the flight. And then just before she's about to get rid of everything, another coworker contacts her saying, I am driving a truck to Florida of some sort so I can pick up her things and bring them down to the house. And so it's just so beautiful to see the providence of God providing mm-hmm. for the women we serve and just, you know, the trust. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that mm-hmm. allows the Lord to lavish his love on us.
For Sister Jean Marie and for Sister Mary Grace, life is valuable in all its forms. Sitting with them, listening to them describe how they see the world and what they're doing in it, it was clear to me that they find themselves utterly loved by God and that they want other people to know they're loved as well.
And we see that through the women we serve, whether they're in difficult pregnancies and struggling, needing help, or whether it's on retreats with young people, or whether it's walking on the streets, running into people on ferries or on trains, that when people are loved for who they are and that they know the truth of themselves and how good they are and how loved they are by God, that they become truly themselves. And especially when they've experienced some kind of hurt or wounds or they've had a tough life, this truth enables them to be themselves and to dream again in times in their lives when they didn't think they could, to believe again that new beginnings are always possible and that there's a future ahead. So we have a beautiful work and it's a privilege to be sisters.
This has been Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart, and Natasha's been speaking with Sister Jean Marie and Sister Mary Grace, Sisters of Life, who were in Sydney recently visiting the University of Notre Dame.
We have a new episode of Life and Faith out every week, so if you liked this conversation, do subscribe to the podcast, leave us a rating or review, and spread the word to others who you think would like it as well. Next week...
Actually, I think the voice of authentic philosophy is being lost in the babble that is popular science, popular psychology, popular history, but then just the chatter of social media. So I think philosophy has to work to recover its authority, and part of the way of doing that is to demonstrate the inadequacies of these other things. Not the inadequacy of science, but the inadequacy of the idea that science can be the answer to everything.